Good afternoon, everybody. And Stephen, thank you very much for that very generous introduction. It's a pleasure to be able to speak in another CEDAR event, especially one down here in Melbourne. So thank you very much for the invitation. Over the past couple of years, one of the central themes of the Reserve Bank's communication has been that the Australian economy is in a period of transition. A transition from the biggest resources boom in over a century to something that's just a little bit more normal. Now, the sheer scale of this resources boom has meant that this transition has its challenges, and that these challenges are being compounded by events beyond our shores. A second theme of our communication has been that a reasonably successful transition is possible, and indeed it is probable. And my own view is that this reflects the underlying positive fundamentals of our economy and its underlying flexibility. This flexibility was important in helping us deal with the upswing of the resources boom, and it's now helping us deal with the downside of that. And a third theme of our communication has been that monetary policy is helping in the adjustment, but the likelihood of a successful transition would be boosted by a lift in underlying productivity growth and an increase in the expected risk-adjusted return on capital formation, and that's both physical capital and human capital. So today I'd like to take the opportunity to again touch on each of these three themes. I want to start with developments in the global economy, particularly in China, as they form a very important backdrop to what's going on here. And then I'd like to use the second half of the talk to talk a little about the ongoing adjustment in our own economy. It probably doesn't come as any surprise to you to say that the main news over the past month or so is really out of China. Two developments in particular have caught people's attention. The first was the large decline in the Chinese equity market, and the second was the decision by the Chinese authorities to allow the RMB to depreciate against the US dollar. As you can see here in this first chart, the Chinese equity market, or in the Chinese equity market, prices have fallen by around 40% since mid-June. And this fall has reversed around two-thirds of the increase that occurred over the previous year. Now, the reasons for the earlier increase are not entirely clear. One possible factor was that the Chinese authorities reduced some or removed some of the restrictions on margin financing. Another possibility was the expectation of Chinese citizens of future capital gains as the equity market opened up to offshore investors. And a third possibility was the weakness in the property market in China. Whatever the reasons for it, things went too far, as they often do. Many investors thought that the increase in equity prices would keep going, and many were prepared to borrow to get into what they saw as a rising market. A bubble developed here, and then it burst. While this has attracted much attention around the world, I think it's fair to say that these movements in the Chinese equity market aren't likely to have material direct effects on the Chinese economy. In terms of the exchange rate, for much of the past few years, the RMB has moved closely with the US dollar, and you can see that in that light blue line there. This meant that as the US dollar appreciated over the last year or so, so too did the Chinese currency. So on a trade-weighted index basis, the RMB was up around 15% between mid-2014 and July this year. So that's a substantial increase. With the US and the Chinese economies being in clearly different parts of the business cycle, it's perhaps unsurprising that the Chinese authorities might have come to the conclusion that greater flexibility of the RMB against the US dollar was warranted. Notably, a move in this direction is consistent with the authorities' long-standing goal of transitioning to a more market-determined exchange rate. And while this change in the Chinese exchange rate has also attracted a lot of attention, I think we do need to keep in mind the magnitude of the change. At around 3%, the recent depreciation's hardly out of line with the short-term movements that we often see amongst the major freely floating currencies of the world. These developments in the Chinese financial markets have coincided with signs of some further slowing in the Chinese economy. And you can see that in this chart here. There's been a slowing in growth of industrial production, retail sales, and fixed asset investment. And the same general pattern is evident in Chinese exports and in the various Chinese business surveys. One area that's looked a little better of recent times is the residential property market. You can see that in the bottom right here. While the aggregate level prices are still lower than they were a year ago across the country, in the larger cities in particular, prices have stopped falling and have actually risen a bit recently. If you put these various pieces of news together, they've had significant ripple effects on global equity markets over the past few months. Volatility's picked up, and many of the major equity markets, including Australia's market, are down by 10% or more from levels a few months ago. The volatility's also transmitted to the commodity markets, and most commodity prices are lower than they were a few months ago. I think it's noteworthy, though, and it's important to note that there's increased volatility in both the commodity markets and the equity markets has not led to dislocation in financial markets more broadly. There has not been any deterioration in funding markets, and credit spreads have mostly moved in a fairly narrow range over the past month or so. So that's something that I think is encouraging. These recent developments in China have understandably shone the spotlight on the outlook for the Chinese economy. And at the moment, assessing this outlook is complicated by the fact that China is simultaneously adjusting to slower growth in its potential output and dealing with a relatively soft part of its own business cycle. The slowing in potential output growth in China, after a truly extraordinary period of sustained double-digit growth, was inevitable. And indeed, it was widely expected. It has, however, brought into quite sharp focus some of the structural challenges facing the Chinese economy. These challenges include the challenge of shifting from investment-led to consumption-led growth, the challenge of liberalising important factors of production, or the markets for important factors of production, including labour, land, capital and energy, the challenges brought about by demographic change, with the Chinese working age population now declining and the overall population ageing quite quickly, and the challenge of dealing with various strains and distortions in the financial system and in the Chinese property market. At various times over the past few years, the Chinese authorities have indeed acknowledged each of these challenges, and a range of plans have been developed to deal with each of them. However, it's yet to be seen how successful these various plans will ultimately be. There's no doubt that the Chinese authorities have, over the past couple of decades, had a remarkable success in lifting hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. The challenges, though, they face are not getting any easier, and the authorities' recent handling of the stock market crash has led some to ponder the general direction of Chinese policy, including the likely pace of reform across the economy. And this is an issue that I think we'll all be watching very closely over the months ahead. From a cyclical perspective, the authorities have recently taken a number of steps to support growth. An important one of these is some increased spending on infrastructure. Another is a reduction in nominal benchmark interest rates, which you can see here. Although with inflation having declined in China over the past year, real interest rates have actually risen a bit. As you can see on the right-hand panel there, reserve requirements in the banking system have also been lowered, although this looks designed to offset the withdrawal of liquidity that's taken place as the Chinese authorities have sold foreign exchange reserves in response to private capital outflows out of China. And the depreciation of the RMB against the US dollar, which I spoke about a minute ago, could also be expected to provide some support at the margin to the Chinese economy. So overall, it's a complicated picture in Australia's largest single trading partner. We did become used to extraordinarily strong growth in China, and we're now having to get used to something a little less extraordinary. And we're also being reminded that China, like other countries, has a business cycle. It does, though, remain the case that there are very significant mutually beneficial opportunities from deeper relations between Australia and China. As a nation, we need to keep an eye on these opportunities, but at the same time, we need to understand and manage the risks associated with those opportunities. If we look beyond China, elsewhere around the world, the recent economic data have mostly had a slightly more positive tone. The US economy is recording above average growth, and the unemployment rate there is close to most estimates of full employment. In Europe, the economic news has tended to be a bit better than it was earlier in the year, and a recovery of sorts is underway there. In India too, the growth momentum looks to have improved, although working in the other direction in a number of countries in East Asia, both domestic demand and export growth looks to have slowed a bit. On the whole, for the globe as a whole, economic conditions continue to be supported by a decline in oil prices. In addition, the drag from fiscal consolidation has lessened in quite a number of countries, and monetary conditions remain very accommodative around the world. At some point, before too long, I think we should hope that the US economy is sufficiently strong for the Federal Reserve to begin the process of normalising interest rates there. A stronger US economy is clearly good for the world. The financial market developments, however, will need to be watched very carefully, given that policy interest rates in the US have been at zero for almost 7 years now, and the last increase in interest rates in the United States was 9 years ago. If we put all this together, when the RBA published its latest forecast a bit over a month ago, we were expecting GDP and our trading partners to grow at around an average pace for the next couple of years, and you can see that in the red bars here. While recent news on global industrial production has tended to be a bit on the softer side, on balance, the recent data have not changed the general outlook materially. We still expect GDP growth in our major trading partners to average around 4% this year and next, although given the recent developments in East Asia, the risks are probably tilted a little to the downside around this central forecast. So that's the global economy. I now want to turn to the adjustment in our own economy. And I think the broad story is very well known here. Over the past decade, Australia has experienced an extremely large external shock in the form of a resources boom. And this boom has had three phases, and you can see them here. In the first phase, there was a very large increase in commodity prices. In the second phase, there was a very large increase in investment in the resources sector. And in the third phase, there's a very large increase in resource sector production and in exports. While these various phases have overlapped at times, we are now very much in this third phase, with higher production generating higher exports, but commodity prices considerably lower than they were a few years ago, and resource sector investment returning to more normal levels. During the first two phases, there was a significant reallocation of resources within our economy. And this was important in helping the economy not overheat in what was an extremely large external shock. But the adjustment back the other way is now taking place, and it's been taking place for some time. Indeed, the terms of trade have been declining for almost 4 years now, after having reached a peak in the second half of 2011, Over this period, the global supply of commodities has increased very substantially as the new investment projects, many of which are in Australia, have come on stream. As a result of this, the prices of our exports relative to our imports have fallen by around 30%. And this decline in the terms of trade brings the terms of trade back to their level in the mid-2000s. Well, it is important to remember that at that level, they're still considerably higher than they were on average in the 1990s and in the previous decade. As you can see, the peak in mining investment occurred around a year after the peak in the terms of trade. In mid-2012, mining investment reached a record peak of around $30 billion per quarter. It's an extraordinary number. Since that time, mining investment has fallen significantly. It's currently around $20 billion per quarter. Further declines still lie ahead as current projects are completed. Although the end of the large declines now looks to be coming into sight, our current forecast is that mining investment will decline to around $10 billion per quarter by the end of 2017. And if this does turn out to be correct, then we're currently halfway through the decline in mining investment. In contrast, the ramp-up in resource sector output is still underway, as you can see on the bottom panel there. Over the past 3 years, resource exports are up 20%, and annual increases of 9% are expected over the next couple of years as LNG production increases. While there's inevitably some degree of imprecision in any estimates, the increase in LNG exports is expected to boost GDP growth by an average of around 0.75 percentage point in each of 2016 and 2017. That's a significant contribution. Now, right through this third phase of the mining boom, the economy has been, on average, growing between 2 and 2.5%, as you can see here. At the quarterly level, the readings for GDP continue to be affected by fluctuations in mining production due to the weather. But if you look through the quarterly volatility, the data for the most recent quarter suggests the economy is continuing to grow at a rate similar to that of the past few years. Most other recent indicators are also consistent with a moderate expansion in our economy, and you can see this in this chart. Measures of business conditions have improved, and most of them are now above average. The unemployment rate has been little changed for over a year, and the demand for labour has increased, so there's been a rise in the employment relative to the working age population. The housing cycle remains in a strong upswing, and household consumption is growing moderately. For many people in the community, though, the fact that growth is occurring at only a moderate pace is disappointing. Growth has been slower than we'd become used to, and slower than I think we're capable of. And in terms of our incomes, this has been compounded by the decline in the prices of our key exports. As a result of these developments, there's been very little growth in our real income per capita for quite a few years now, after we'd had a decade and a half of extraordinarily strong growth in real income per capita. Now, while this disappointment is understandable, we should not allow it to cause us to lose sight of the fact that the economy has shown a considerable ability to adjust, and to do so in a way that preserves both overall economic and financial stability. We've adjusted to the upside of a huge positive international demand shock without the economy overheating and imbalances developing. And we're now adjusting to the downside while still managing to grow at a moderate rate. I think this is a significant achievement, and it is testimony to the underlying flexibility of our economy. And this flexibility should give us some confidence that we can manage the future. An important element of this flexibility is the exchange rate. When the terms of trade initially started to fall and the decline in mining investment was clearly in sight, the exchange rate was relatively slow to adjust. And on quite a number of occasions, the Reserve Bank drew attention to this. But the exchange rate has now adjusted considerably, and this adjustment has continued over recent weeks. So just as the appreciation helped stabilise the economy in the upswing of the boom in commodity price and mining investment, the depreciation is helping us manage the downswing. One example of this is in the tourism industry. As the relative cost of overseas travel has increased with the lower Australian dollar, more Australians are holidaying domestically and more people are visiting our shores. Encouragingly, we're now seeing some signs that this change in travel patterns is promoting a pickup in investment in tourism infrastructure. In particular, there's been a noticeable increase in the stock of work to be done in the construction of hotel and related accommodation. You can see this in this chart. The bank's liaison with tourism-related businesses suggests that further increases in investment in this area are likely over coming years, and conditions have also improved in a number of other sectors that are sensitive to the exchange rate. Another element of the flexibility has been the labour market, both in terms of labour supply and wages. During the upswing, population growth picked up noticeably, partly due to a rise in immigration. And this helped alleviate some of the pressures in the labour market that would otherwise have occurred, especially in areas where skills are in short supply. In the downward phase now, population growth has slowed, partly again due to immigration, and aggregate wage growth, as you can see here, has moderated very significantly. This moderation in wage growth has played a role in generating sufficient employment growth to keep the unemployment rate steady, despite below average growth in the overall economy. And the third element of this flexibility has been monetary policy. As the Reserve Bank has frequently noted, it's entirely appropriate that during a period in which both the terms of trade and mining investment are declining, that monetary policy is accommodative. This current stance of policy is helping support growth in the overall economy, even if it's not working quite the same way as it used to. The support is most clearly evident in the interest-sensitive housing construction sector. Investment in housing construction is up 7% over the past year. And the stronger housing market is also having some positive ripple effects on parts of the retail sector. So together, the flexibility of the exchange rate, the labour market and monetary policy is helping with the cyclical adjustment in our economy. The missing ingredient continues to be a lift in non-mining business investment, and we're still waiting for convincing signs of a pickup there. The latest reading from the ABS on firms' capital spending plans outside the resources sector did show a slight improvement from earlier readings, but a material lift in non-mining business investment still seems to be some way off. In time, though, I think we should expect that the adjustments that we've seen in these cyclical variables, the exchange rate, the labour market, and interest rates, will help create the environment that does lead to increased business investment. There are clearly limits, though, here. A low exchange rate, low growth in wages, and low interest rates are not the basis for sustained increases in investment and output. They can certainly help during the adjustment phase, but ultimately we will be better off if increased investment is driven by high expected returns rather than the low cost of finance or low wages. And I think this is why the focus on improving the climate of business investment is so important. There's no magic bullet here, but surely the investment climate would be improved through a strong focus by both business and government on innovation, on productivity, on human capital, and entrepreneurship. These are all topics that I've spoken about on previous occasions. I think on that note, Stephen, I will hand the microphone back to you, and thank you, everybody, for listening. And I'd be happy to answer questions.
Yes. Well, thank you, Dr. Lowe. Thank you so much for that presentation that has covered the global economy, the Australian economy, talking in particular about China and its effect on Australia, and significantly, of course, around the Australian adjustment and the strategies that are there. Some very strong messages I think you've left us with. Now, the process, of course, is that questions can be asked, and there will be a roving microphone coming around. But as chairman, I'm exercising the right to ask the first one, which doesn't surprise you, I'm sure. The current circumstances of Australia have been described as something of the new normal if you take into consideration the 2 plus 2 plus 2. 2% interest rates, 2% GDP, 2% or thereabouts rates of inflation. If Australia is adjusting, is the 2 plus 2 plus 2 scenario something that really we have to be taking into even more detailed consideration, and in fact adjusting ourselves even more so to accommodate?
I think that's too pessimistic an assessment, because I think in the medium term we can grow faster than 2%. Estimating potential output growth is fraught with difficulties, but a number closer to 3 rather than 2 I think would be what most of our analysis would suggest. So it's a matter of the economy transitioning through this period of declining in mining investment and then returning to something that I think is likely to be more sustainable. And as I said in my remarks, the thing that for that to occur, we need business investment to increase. I think that will eventually happen, but that we need to see that happen. And if that happens, then I think we can grow at a number closer to 3 than 2. After all, the population is still growing at 1.5% a year. So if you think 2% is our potential growth rate, you're really saying that growth in labour force productivity, output per hour worked, is only around 0.5%. I think that's way too pessimistic an assessment. So I think we can do better than that, and in time we will do better than that.
Okay. Hi, who you are. Ask a question rather than perhaps engage in a dialogue. That would be great. Thank you.
Ben Potter from the Australian Financial Review. Thank you, Dr. Lowe. Recently, or in the last several months, the Governor has talked about business hurdle rates of return, expected rates of return for CapEx being too high or not having adjusted to the new environment regarding growth and cost of capital. I noticed it was left out of your address, and I just wondered whether that's an idea that you've dropped. You've had we had some pretty strong pushback against it from directors of, or one individual who's a director of BHP and Transurban, who said we invest for 50, 60 years and we're not going to change our approach because of what may turn out to be a short-term change in the outlook. So I'm wondering if the bank's view on that has changed at all, or you still think business could adjust its sides. Thank you.
Our view has not changed there at all. I think I've spoke to a lot of businesses about this, and what I detect is quite a range of experience here. Some businesses have lowered the hurdle rates of return as the cost of financing has come down, but there are many that haven't, that are still using hurdle rates of return that they were using prior to the financial crisis. And the point that we had been making was that if the weighted average cost of capital had come down through lower bond costs and lower cost of equity, then firms should also be considering at least lowering the hurdle rates of return on their investments. And some, as I said, some have, but some have not. And if we are in a world of kind of low growth, I don't think it's as pessimistic as the one you're articulating, Stephen, but if we are in a world of low growth, then hurdle rates of return do need to come down, because the physical capital stock would not be able to generate the type of returns that we historically had become used to. I'm not that pessimistic, but I think it is an issue for many firms about what rate of return they're actually expecting to earn on their capital.
Maria Wilton, Franklin Templeton. You spoke about improving the business climate, and we talked earlier about the role of animal spirits and the ability for governments and regulators to jawbone. Do you see that there is a role for government to improve the business and climate? Are there things that they should be or could be doing to help things along?
I don't want to be kind of offering gratuitous advice here, but there are certain things that when you talk to business and you talk to people in public policy that repeatedly come up. And the things here that I would I think it's worth focusing on, and I'm not sure what the answers on each of those are, but kind of the culture of innovation. How do we increase the incentives for innovation? How do we increase the reward for innovation? How do we to improve the climate of innovation? Another would be, how do we develop the human capital that's required to drive a high value-added economy? I think there's a role probably for increased investment in infrastructure in some places, not only to support aggregate demand in the economy, but to improve the productive capacity of the economy. And I think generally improving the competitive environment, because I'm struck by, again, when I talk to businesses, how often they cite competition from another firm as the reason for them to do something better. So improving the innovation climate, improving our human capital, improving competition, and improving infrastructure. It seems to me that's the basis of a kind of a set of reforms that could, in fact, create this business environment that where people feel like, it is worth taking a risk and investing in capital again. How you do on each of those things, I'm a central banker. I think these are the issues where we should be focusing on.
Yes, Graham Cray, BlueScope Steel. Philip, hearing you talk about the investment, lack of business investment, and some good reasons for it, it seems to me the other factor at play is we've come through massive transition and unwinding, and that other side of the transition is equally massive. We get very quick response from consumers to things like exchange rate movements and so on, and you'd expect that. But business investment is going to take longer, I think. The lag, the natural lead time is greater. So I'm not quite as pessimistic as one would suggest about the lack of business investment, perhaps with the exception of, government-sponsored, government-led infrastructure investment. I wonder what you think about that comment in terms of the lag time on that sort of business investment in an area that's been smashed for 5 years in the upside of the resources boom. They're going to take a bit of time before they start investing again, I would have thought.
Well, business investment is always frustratingly slow to come. I've seen, in Australia we haven't had that many business cycles recently, but I'm old enough to have seen at least one or two of them, and it's a recurring theme that business investment just takes a while to come. And a point I was trying to make in my remarks was that a number of the preconditions for this to actually take place are now there. The exchange rate's much lower, interest rates are lower, the population's still growing strongly. In many industries, the capital stock or investment in new capital has been barely enough to replace depreciation, so the capital stock relative to output has declined. And you see businesses being confident enough at the moment to hire workers. Employment growth has been relatively strong. And business conditions, as I showed in one of my charts, are actually above average. Businesses are reporting that current conditions right today, almost in every industry, are above average. So many of the conditions are there. I think this is why we are fundamentally optimistic that the economy will return to a period of stronger growth, because the basic conditions for a pickup in business investment are there. It's just frustrating, I think, for the community at large that this is kind of not happening, but I think it will come. And I hope you're right.
Councillor Rod McDonald from the City of Greater Geelong. Sort of a double question. Around China, perhaps a decade ago, I was given numbers that up to 80% of Chinese economy was driven by domestic demand, so that they, because of their strong growth and in the country and the changes that you outlined in your speech before. But does that sort of number still stack up in light of that growth now? And probably the second part you've sort of answered, but with it was around the economy and the fluctuations because of we're subject to the, you know, obviously the vagaries of the resource prices. What sort of policy settings do you see that could encourage, for example, advanced manufacturing or structural change? I note some of the specifics that you said before, but just thinking about some of the settings that we could actually get the structural change within the country.
I'll take the second part first. I don't really have a long list of reforms that would make a difference here. The lower exchange rate, though, does make a difference. So, again, in discussions that the Reserve Bank of Australia staff have with business, in recent months, quite a number of businesses have focused on the fact that the currency is lower. Is at least raising the possibility now that they might be competitive, and given their underlying strengths and particular advantages that certain businesses have, that the lower currency is now giving them hope that they can actually leverage those in a way that previously they might not have been able to do. And I think that the type of things that I talked about to an earlier question at a structural level would help as well. In terms of China, I don't know what kind of about this the 80% number, but what we're seeing in China is, and this process is, I think, going to go on for a couple of decades, is a fundamental reorientation of the economy. The growth model to date has been based on exports and building infrastructure. And as a result of that, the share of consumption in national income has been unusually low. Unusually low relative to China's history, but also unusually low internationally. So the household sector has not got a very large share of national income. And of the share they've got, they've saved a lot of it because people weren't sure about social security, they weren't sure about education, they weren't sure about kind of the health system. So people saved for these things. And the economy is now going through a period of transition where more income is going into the household sector, and over time, hopefully, households will be prepared to spend a greater share of that income that they get. And so that's changing the nature of Chinese growth. It's no longer, in the next decade, it won't be as heavy emphasis on exports or on infrastructure. And that has implications, I think, for us about the type of trade relationship we need to develop with China. It needs to go beyond exporting resources to other areas of our comparative advantage. That would include agriculture, services, tourism, and as you highlighted, high-tech manufacturing. So as China evolves, I think our trade relationship with China does and will evolve as well.
Please. Russell Yardley, I'm on the board of NICTA, soon to become Data 61 with CSIRO. I am encouraged by your comments about focusing on the issue of innovation. When you look at the indices, Australia is usually in the OECD 30 out of 30 in terms of collaboration around innovation and science. What sort of financial incentives, what sort of financial reforms do you think are needed to help encourage the investment in innovation and science and research?
I'm straying way beyond my area of competency here, so I can only reflect the type of things that I read. And the two things that kind of strike some resonance with me are the relatively poor record that Australia has of collaboration between the universities and businesses. Some people dispute that, but the international scores, we do not rank particularly highly there. So that is obviously one area there that is kind of a candidate to look at. And the other is, I think, kind of the general incentives that are set up through the tax system and the bankruptcy code. Most economic actions are driven by incentives. It's something you learn very early on in economics. And so what can public policy do to change the incentives for innovation? And I think the tax system and the bankruptcy code are two areas, again, that it's worth taking a look at. But I don't want to kind of advocate particular policy changes here, but I think they're the areas. And I'm back on the universities, the kind of the incentive structure, again, within the universities for them to collaborate with business. There are some kind of fantastic examples, but there aren't enough of them. And how do universities change their own internal incentive structures to encourage a deeper relationship with business?
Well, case studies, of course, Philip, the University of Wollongong. But if I could just jump in with a question, there has been an emphasis in any of the discussion about Australia adjusting around reform. And the word itself has sort of grown in meaning to different people. The governor recently at the Economic Reform Summit in Sydney suggested that the word reform need to be replaced. And I think he talked about growth. I wonder, in terms of the bank's attitude to just growth as opposed to any reform mechanisms that might be needed to sustain that growth, are the two mutually exclusive, or are we in fact, you know, we're talking about something different, or we're talking about something that actually is the same? Doesn't matter what it's called.
I think it's really an issue of semantics, but an important one. Because when you talk about reform, the general public, you often get a sense that, oh, it's all a bit boring.
Not for this audience, but
for the community as a whole. It's kind of technical, it's hard work, it's kind of not that interesting. I've heard this before. So people don't really relate to the kind of the need for reform, but the idea that the economy needs to grow more strongly, it needs to generate stronger growth in wages, stronger growth in real living standards, stronger growth in our collective wealth. That's something that people can relate to, and so it's really about the framing. If we frame the question as how do we reform, then you lose people straight away. If you frame the question as how do we grow the pie, how do we grow our real incomes, how do we grow our wealth, that's something that's much easier, I hope, for people to kind of catalyse around. But you obviously need to do the kind of hard work on reform to get the growth, but maybe framing the question about how do we get growth is a better way of framing the question. And if you look, as I remarked in my talk, if you look at real income per capita in Australia, today it's no higher than it was in the beginning of 2008. So that's a pretty good measure of kind of average living standards. If you go the 15 years before that, real income per capita grew at around 2.5% a year for 15 years. In the 1990s, it was productivity growth. Then in the 2000s, it was a lift in the terms of trade. And right through that period, we had a very favourable demographic with the share of children in the population declining. But the demographic dividend's over. The terms of trade are declining, and productivity growth is slower than it was in the 1990s. So the whole kind of wealth generation mechanism, the way our average living standards were rising, that's all changed. And we need to kind of refocus the discussion on how to get back to having our real income per capita, which is ultimately the measure of economic success we have. How can we get that to grow again?
I'll jump in again. Reflecting on the Chinese circumstance and the fact that on best estimates, approximately 7% GDP, and that's still not bad compared to the rest of the world. But I did read recently where I think a minister suggested that perhaps Australia had fallen into a trap of fundamentally putting all its eggs in the one Chinese basket. If we are to sustain the growth narrative that you've just alluded to now, does that mean in terms of the way in which Australian businesses engage with the rest of the globalised village in which we operate, it is about perhaps diversifying a little more and a little more quickly instead of simply relying on a major player that's been able to sustain us through a commodities boom?
Well, diversification is always good. It's hard to argue against that proposition. But China still offers us tremendous opportunities. I spoke in my remarks, or I think maybe a bit earlier, about the shift in demand that's going on there, and that opens up tremendous opportunities for us. So I don't think we should worry that too much of our economic effort is devoted towards China, but we do need to diversify where we can. And if you think about India, you know, it's quite possible that the next decade and a half or two decades is a very good period for India. And again, we have strong business relationships and the kind of a large number of Indian nationals who've migrated to Australia. So I think there are kind of opportunities right across the region. We shouldn't kind of feel bad about having a deep, developed relationship with the economy that will ultimately be the largest economy in the world one day.
Perhaps the final question, Governor, Seat of Governor, Graham Cray, second bite of the cherry, only because you're a governor.
Thank you. Philip, just in support, really in support of that last comment about China remaining a big opportunity, I think we tend to get locked into the thinking about 7% growth. It used to be 7.5% and it used to be 8%. But all of that ignores the fact that 7 or 8 years ago, the Chinese economy was half the size of what it is today. So the increment of growth of 7% today on an economy much bigger than what it was 10 years ago is still not at all shabby. The opportunities remain very substantial, but they're a bit different because of the changing nature of the Chinese economy. Is that a fair comment?
6 or 7% growth is the new 12, or it's really the same 12, because China's economy growing at 7% now is very similar to, in terms of the quantum of additional output, is very similar to 12% growth not that long ago. I don't think we should worry too much that the Chinese growth is not 12 anymore. It's going to be, you know, in the next couple of years, probably 6 or 7%, and that's still a large increase in the quantum of global output. And as I've said a couple of times, the nature of the opportunities that China offers us is changing. But there are opportunities there, and I can see them right across the board. You just look at the tourism industry, the number of Chinese nationals that are now taking holidays in Australia, it's staggering, the growth there, and we're probably only on the early cusp of that. And in a number of other services industries where Australia has a reputation for delivering high quality innovative services, there's tremendous opportunity, and in agriculture one could say the same. So now China's obviously going through a difficult transition in a way, the same way we are, but we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that in the end this is going to be good for us if we can take advantage of those opportunities. There are risks, of course. The more concentrated your portfolio, the greater the risk. So they're risks that we need to manage. But we shouldn't become so risk-averse that we want to minimise that risk and give up the fantastic opportunity that still lies ahead of us there with that relationship.